language of hungering, of feeding, of eating, of drinking are built into what we call the Christian faith. A faith that God has invited us to taste and to see His goodness. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 11, and we'll read through that portion of Scripture that we've all been looking forward to in coming to this book, the food laws in Leviticus. We'll read through the chapter just to acquaint ourselves with it. We'll launch into things this morning. Leviticus 11, beginning in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, these are the living things that you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Whatever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed, and chews the cud among the animals, you may eat. Nevertheless, among those that chew the cud or part the hoof, you shall not eat these. The camel, because it chews the cud, but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. The rock badger, because it chews the cud, but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. And the hare, because it chews the cud, but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. And the pig, because it parts the hoof and is cloven-footed, but does not chew the cud, is unclean to you. You shall not eat any of their flesh, and you shall not touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you. These you may eat of all that are in the waters. Everything in the waters that has fins and scales, whether in the seas or in the rivers, you may eat. But anything in the seas or the rivers that has not fins and scales, of the swarming creatures in the waters and of the living creatures that are in the waters, is detestable to you. You shall regard them as detestable. You shall not eat any of their flesh, and you shall detest their carcasses. Everything in the waters that has not fins and scales is detestable to you. And these you shall detest among the birds. They shall not be eaten. They are detestable. The eagle, the bearded vulture, the black vulture, the kite, the falcon of any kind, every raven of any kind, the ostrich, the night hawk, the seagull, the hawk of any kind, the little owl, the cormorant, the short-eared owl, the barn owl, the tawny owl, the carrion vulture, the stork, the heron of any kind, the hoopoe, and the bat." I know you were looking forward to eating hoopoe this afternoon. Verse 20. "All winged insects that go on all fours are detestable to you. Yet among the winged insects that go on all fours, you may eat those that have jointed legs above their feet and with which to hop on the ground. Of them you may eat the locust of any kind, the bald locust of any kind, the cricket of any kind, and the grasshopper of any kind. All other winged insects that have 4 feet are detestable to you. By these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches their carcass shall be unclean until the evening, and whoever carries any part of their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. Every animal that parts the hoof, but is not cloven-footed, or does not chew the cud, is unclean to you. Everyone who touches them shall be unclean. And all that walk on their paws among the animals that go on all fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcasses shall be unclean until the evening. And he who carries their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. They are unclean to you. And these are unclean to you among the swarming things that swarm on the ground: the mole rat, the mouse, the great lizard of any kind, the gecko, the monitor lizard, the lizard, the sand lizard, and the chameleon. These are unclean to you among all that swarm. Whoever touches them when they are dead shall be unclean until the evening, and anything on which any of them falls when they are dead shall be unclean, whether it is an article of wood, or a garment, or a skin, or a sack, any article that is used for any purpose. It must be put into water, and it shall be unclean until the evening, then it shall be clean. And if any of them falls into any earthenware vessel, all that is in it shall be unclean, and you shall break it. Any food in it that could be eaten, on which water comes, shall be unclean. And all drink that could be drunk from every such vessel shall be unclean. And everything on which any part of their carcass falls shall be unclean, whether oven or stove, it shall be broken in pieces. They are unclean and shall remain unclean for you. Nevertheless, a spring or a cistern holding water shall be clean. But whoever touches a carcass in them shall be unclean. And if any part of their carcass falls upon any seed of grain that is to be sown, it is clean. But if water is put on the seed, and any part of their carcass falls on it, it is unclean to you. And if any animal which you eat, may eat, dies, whoever touches its carcass shall be unclean until the evening. Whoever eats of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening, and whoever carries the carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. Every swarming thing that swarms on the ground is detestable. It shall not be eaten. Whatever goes on its belly, whatever goes on all fours, whatever has many feet, any swarming thing that swarms on the ground, you shall not eat, for they are detestable. You shall not make yourselves detestable with any swarming thing that swarms. You shall not defile yourselves with them and become unclean through them. Because I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not defile yourselves with any swarming thing that crawls on the ground, for I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. This is the law about beast and bird and every living creature that moves through the waters and every creature that swarms on the ground, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, between the living creature that may be eaten and the living creature that may not be eaten. Okay, we got through that. As we come to this portion of Scripture, the title of this sermon is simply this: Bringing Our Appetites into Submission. This is one of those passages that follows fairly well along last week's sermon. Remember the verse in Psalm 34, verse 8? Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. And He's given us foods and festivals in order to drive that home to us, to help us understand what the goodness of the Lord tastes like, what the goodness of the Lord smells like, feels like, sounds like. We get to enjoy, in a sensory fashion, the goodness of our great God. Nothing is really more practical than food when it comes down to it. And God says, I want you to take time in your festivals, your feasts, to taste my goodness. But for us, this side of the cross, at first blush at least, nothing to us is less practical than Leviticus chapter 11. I mean, I did not hear stomachs growling when the Bible gave you permission to eat crickets and grasshoppers. Nobody was firing up the Weber and saying, I was so looking forward to grasshopper legs when we get home. Forget it, I'm going to eat the whole locust. Okay, I want a whole skewer of them. At first blush, this passage seems as though it's antiquated, obsolete, obtuse, totally distant from us. Mosley writes, Leviticus 11 applies to our lives in important and practical ways. I like how Ross puts it. He says, because Leviticus 11 is a detailed classification of the animals for Israel's food as either clean or unclean, it's unlikely that too many Christians will feel compelled to study the chapter in any detail. This is unfortunate, because this very remarkable chapter forms the basis of the daily dietary regulations for the Hebrews and serves to reflect the holiness of God, and its message should not be missed. My goal this morning is to convince you that Leviticus 11 does indeed have some important instruction for us. In fact, some most important instruction for us, because it's aimed at what we learn to love. What you gain a taste for is what you get a desire for. What you have a desire for, you learn to love. And God says to his children, thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength, your might. And as God is giving these commands to the children of Israel, he says, I want you to learn to love something more than food. I want you to learn to love me. And I want you to put practices into your life that give you a taste for me above your taste for meats, above your taste for foods. I want to be Lord of all your life. You're going to look different. There's going to be things that you can't do that others can. I'm not concerned about them. I'm concerned about you. You as my people who are supposed to show forth my holiness to other people so that they can be drawn in. It's imperative that you learn to curb your appetites so that you learn to love me more and you learn to love this world less. Now that's an important message for Old Testament believers or New Testament believers, both sides of the cross. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 23. My son, keep your heart with all diligence, because out of your heart is the wellspring of life. Where your heart runs, your feet will walk. And so he says, learn to put your appetites under the authority of Almighty God, and you'll be safe. You won't be sorry, especially in a crazy, mixed-up world like what we have today. So as we come to this portion of clean and unclean, our proposition is simply this. Learn to hone your heart with a holy hunger. You like all those H's in there? I worked hard on that. Actually, I didn't. It just kind of came. Okay. But really, we've got to train our hearts. Training our appetites is a part of training our hearts. And that's what God is getting at in this passage. We're training our hearts not so that they don't have any hunger, but that they hunger for the right things. We're not called to be ascetic warriors, those who put off all desires of the heart and we reject all things and eat bread and water. That's not at all what he's getting at. But he's trying to help them to train their hearts to learn to love him more and this less. That's the whole point of this passage. So I find in this passage that there's three lessons in developing a holy hunger. The first is this. We need to learn to feed on what God calls clean. And he reveals it to us. They wouldn't understand it apart from God's instruction. Now, this isn't the first time we find out about clean and unclean animals. Back in the days of Noah, God tells Noah to take some clean animals, seven of the clean, two of the unclean. The only thing is, we don't know what they are at the point. And at this point, with the children of Israel having lived inside the nation of Egypt for some 400 years, they don't know either. We see up at the very beginning of this passage, up in verse 1, God speaks to whom? Who's God talking to? Moses and Aaron. Go back to chapter 10, verse 10, and you'll see why this is important. Chapter 10, verse 10. Verse 8, the Lord spoke to Aaron, verse 10, and said, you, Aaron, are to distinguish between the holy and the common, between the unclean and the clean. God is talking to Aaron and Moses, who's overseeing this whole program at this point. But Aaron in particular says, Aaron, listen. You, as the high priest, are supposed to help the people to understand and distinguish and make a distinction between, does this pass, does this not pass? Is this clean, is this unclean? Is this holy, is this unholy? Common. And so he's helping Aaron in particular to get a hold of what his job is, and he's giving him some definitions. He's giving him some handles. He's giving him some very detailed applications here as far as what is clean and what is unclean. But as God goes through this, he reveals what's clean. Let's look at verses 2 and 3. He says, speak to the people of Israel, say, these are the living things that you may eat. End of verse 3. Among all the animals, these are the ones that you may eat. See, God reveals what is clean for his people. And as he reveals what's clean, there's an emphasis on God's bounty, not God's restriction. Look at verse 4. Verse 3. Whatever parts the hoof, anything that parts the hoof, and he goes on and explains now, parts the hoof and chews the cud. And then he goes on to verse 9. He says, everything in the waters that has fins and scales. Verse 22, he adds a little phrase with all these crickets and grasshoppers and all these different kind of jumping animals. He says, this of any kind, and this of any kind, and this of any kind, and this of any kind, four times. But the whole point is God is saying this, everything, anything, of any kind. He says, listen, I'm really not trying to be stringent. I'm really not trying to be stingy in what I'm giving to you. I want you to have, and I want you to have in abundance. God has always given in abundance, providing for his people. Think back to Genesis 1, verse 29. God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in it. Chapter 2, God said, you may surely eat of every tree in the garden, but or only of this one tree you can't eat. God wants to provide for us abundantly. Sometimes we get the feeling, especially as we oppose a health and wealth gospel, and we do on purpose. We oppose a health and wealth gospel. But that doesn't mean that God is some strict and stingy God who wants us to be poor and cravingly crawling to God and begging God for just a widow's mite. God, I know I'm going to have to buy the milk that's stale this week, but God, would you just give me enough to buy stale milk? That's not what God does for his people. As he's using these terms, and he uses them on purpose, he says, listen, I want you to be able to eat everything that fits in this category, everything that fits in this category, of any kind that fits inside this category, all of it, it's yours. I want you to be able to enjoy it, to eat it. Think of Matthew chapter 5, verse 6. Jesus is giving Beatitudes. Blessed are those. He comes to verse 6. He said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness for what? They're going to be filled up. I love, we just read in our family devotions this week about the feeding of the 5,000. And he breaks the bread and he breaks the fishes and he passes it out. And everybody eats. How much do they eat? They eat till they're full. They eat till they can't eat any more. For Caleb, that's four pizzas, okay? When we have a pizza that's done, like, wow, you're full already? You sure? Not one more piece? They ate till they were full. They were done eating. God wants us in our eating to get full, to feast, to enjoy his great provision for us. Reminded of John chapter 10, verse 10. I am come that they might have life and that they might have it stingily. Abundantly, right? Our God is an abundant giver. Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, coming down from our Father who loves to give. He reminds the disciples, listen, if you as a father are asked by your son for a loaf of bread, are you going to give him a rock? If he asks for an egg, are you going to give him a serpent? How much more doesn't your God, your Father in heaven, want to give and give and give to his children? Jesus says, my disciples, my tender flock, it is my Father's desire to give you the kingdom. And as our God begins to unfold this for his people, he reveals an emphasis on bounty, not restriction. But Satan would always have us to believe a focus is on a strict and stingy God. God has so much out there that he really doesn't want you to have. He's narrowing what he wants to give you to this little bit. That's not it at all. There's an emphasis not only on bounty, but there's an emphasis on life, not death. It allows herbivores, not carnivores. And I found one writer in particular to be helpful in going through this, because there's several different reasons and speculations as to why are these clean and why are these unclean. We don't know. Okay? That's the fact. We don't know. Other than God said. But as you're working through this, there is an emphasis on bounty. There is an emphasis on life. In fact, God says, the ones that chew the what? Chew the cud. Chew the cud. These are all ones that are reliant for their food on things that grow. They don't have to kill in order to get it. They're just eating what God has provided. And they're chewing it at least twice over. They're gaining as much nourishment as they can by re-eating this food for themselves. But DeRoche says this, I propose that the ancients considered as unclean those animals most closely associated with either the murderous activity of the serpent or the divine punishment against him. These are categories in which their minds would have traveled. Our minds don't necessarily naturally travel down these roads. But he says, if we can learn to think in the categories of what these people were thinking, it'll help us to understand a little bit about what's going on here. There's something about the murderous activity of the serpent and the condemnation of the serpent that make things clean or unclean. The beasts most imaging the serpent's craftiness are those predatory in nature, those with a will to kill. All of these are unclean. No clean land animal is a predator. Well, that's helpful. Why? Because our God, who is the living God, is a God of life, not death. Excuse me. I know when we were reading this morning, it probably didn't jump out to you, but Jesus said, I find my life in the Father, and I give life to you. Where something finds its nourishment matters as far as what you nourish yourself upon. And God says, listen, I don't want them to be nourishing themselves on death, that which is opposed to my program. I want them to nourish themselves on life so that you can derive life from life. And that's the point. Life from life, not death from that which feeds on death. There's an emphasis then on blessing, not curse. They're allowed to eat plant eaters, not waste eaters. Those animals, DeRoche says, most identified with the serpent's dust-eating, death-culminating curse would be bottom feeders, and those linked in any way to the realms of death and waste, all of which would be unclean. He allows hooved, but not pawed. This would exclude those cats. It would exclude dogs. It would exclude bears, raccoons, rodents. Hooved animals walk on the tips of their toes or their hooves to support the weight of their bodies. And thus, they touch as little of the dust or the cursed ground as possible. Their weight is carried on the rubbery sole, a hard wall formed by that thick nail on the tip of their toe. God allows leapers, not crawlers. We get down to the insects, and he says, those bugs that hop on the ground are clean, perhaps portraying the defeat of the curse. But all winged insects that do not hop, but simply rest and walk on the ground, those remain unclean. There's an emphasis in all of this on Israel's identity, not primarily their health. One of the writers said, shortly after I got married, his wife and him decided to do this Leviticus 11 diet. He said it really wasn't that hard. We weren't eating too many buzzards and vultures at the time, so they didn't really find it that difficult. But the purpose of God giving this to his people wasn't primarily so that they would be healthy. That wasn't the point. We're reminded later on in the story of Scripture in Acts chapter 10, as God brings reptiles, as God brings clean and unclean animals down before Peter, and he brings it three times. He says, Peter, rise, kill, and what? Eat. If the point is their health, remember what he says after that? What God has called what? Clean, don't you call unclean or common or unholy. God says, these things I mean for you to eat at this time. How about way back at the beginning? And God saw all that he had made, and he saw that it was what? It was good. It was good. Now, there's some speculation. Maybe those things that are in the water that have scales and fins, those are the normal things, and then the abnormal things are the things that are unclean. Except that God made the abnormal things abnormal on purpose, and in their abnormality, he called them good. So the point isn't that if you eat pig, you'll get sick. That's not necessarily the point. We don't eat pig not for health benefits because God told us not to eat pig. In Leviticus chapter 20, verses 25 and 26, the purpose of this, of these laws, these food laws, was so that Israel would maintain a distinction from the nations that surrounded them. You can't eat these things. And you know what? You're going to look different from everybody who does. There's a rush, at least within second and third generation Christianity, those who've grown up in a Christian home, to throw off the standards, to throw off those barriers that make us different from the people around us. And the idea is, you know what, if I can be like them, then I can win them to Jesus. And God is telling his people, listen, don't be like them so that you can win them to me. It seems like a first generation Christian gets that better than those of us who grow up inside of Christianity. I remember the time when a lot of people wouldn't go to a place that served alcohol because they didn't want to, they had that in their standards because they wanted to separate themselves from that kind of living. And today, you can barely find a Christian who even thinks in those terms. Because it, for one reason, it surrounds us. And for another reason, we don't really care. We're not thinking to look different from the world. Our goal is to look as much like the world as we can. I would propose, dear friend, that there's something wrong with our thinking. Maybe not yours, but ours collectively as Christians who are more excited to throw off standards of separation than in willing to brace them. And not carving lines in the sand for everybody else, but in your own life, distinguishing, why am I doing what I'm doing? Is it so that I can be like? Well, it is. But to be like whom? I have one deep, supreme desire, we sang this morning, that I may be like Elvis. No, that I may be like Jesus, right? I have one deep, supreme desire. I'm putting these things in my life so that I can be like Jesus. Now, if I'm like Jesus, Jesus says, if you were of the world would love you. But because you are not of the world, but because I chose you out of the world, the world will what? The world will hate you. And here's the thing. We don't want to be hated. There's a fear of man that grips our hearts. And Proverbs says, be careful because the fear of man brings a what? Brings a snare. But the fear of God brings liberty, brings life. Dear friend, the purpose of these laws was to mark them out as different from the peoples. You can't have fellowship with people that you can't eat with. I'm thankful that the Rices eat everything I eat. So when they come over last week, we get to the end of the day, and we pull out stuff for supper, and it's, you know what? It's just, well, that's great. That's exactly what we like to eat. Okay, keep on fellowshipping. You keep on moving forward because you can eat the same stuff. Imagine, now you bring the stuff out, and here's the special, I'm sorry, I can't eat that. What are you, a snob? I can't eat that. How about this? Can't eat that. You ever had somebody like that? They come over to your house and you didn't find out that they couldn't eat something and you serve it and they're like, what's the matter? Can't eat that. How about this? Can't eat that. Awkward. You're like, this is really good. Water, you know, and the rest of the night, there's like this invisible barrier. Weird, awkward, just, you can't throw your arms around that person. You can't embrace, you're not on the same page. There's this invisible barrier, and that's the whole point. God says, when you get into the land, there's going to be a temptation for your heart to be stolen. There's going to be every reason in the land for you to love everything other than me. I can't afford, and you can't afford, to love anything other than life. Guess what? I'm your life. And if you would love anything other than me, it will cost you your life. Clean and unclean, as we're going to find out in just a little bit, has to do with death and life. And so he says, this is why I've given these to you. Ross writes this, the principal design of these laws enabled the Israelites to exist as a distinct people in the land of Canaan. Close personal friendships are easily formed over a shared meal, but it's far more difficult to develop a relationship with people with whom one can neither eat nor drink. And if these people have an abhorrence of the food that one eats, there's an even greater obstacle to close relationship. So in Leviticus 11, one discovers that the Israelites, by following the law's dietary injunctions, are precluded from assimilating with their pagan neighbors. That's the purpose. You can't get too close because you can't eat together. You can't share together. You can't enjoy together the same things. You can't enjoy together the same things. That's the whole point. Because you're honing your heart to hunger God's holiness. Now, there's a point we need to draw out here. While God does reveal how to determine if it's clean, he doesn't always reveal why. He says, you can eat all of these that fit this category, and here's the ones that don't. And he tells them exactly how they're supposed to discern that. But he doesn't necessarily tell them why. Wenham writes, these chapters look back, as we already pointed out, to chapter 10, verse 10, so that Aaron can help the people of Israel to distinguish between the holy and the common, the clean and the unclean. And the first step in that is to ask oneself, what did God say? What did God say as far as what's clean, what's unclean? Look at verse 4. Nevertheless, among those that chew the cud or part the hoof, you shall what? Not eat these. Oh man, am I thankful for that. Okay, you can eat whatever fits here, just don't eat these. Don't you love it when things are spelled out for you? It's like, wow, I don't have to wonder. It's just like, okay, check, check, check. Oh, okay, check. You keep on moving. The first question that needs to be asked, what did God say? You shall eat these, verse 10, anything that does not. And then 15 times, and only in this chapter, he says, this is unclean to you. This is detestable to you. This is unclean to you. Boy, I wonder if that's unclean. 15 times, this is unclean to you. Why? The first question we have to ask is, what did God say? God is training his people at a child level. Understand this. They're still at the foot of the mount. They've just been given their charter. They've just gotten their constitution. And he's helping them to learn to think through, how do you make decisions? As a responsible child of this king, how do you make decisions and distinctions? The first question is asked, what did God say? What do we always jump to? Why? You ever been around a four-year-old? Why? 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 Why?
Because I said so. Because if you speak again, you're going to have Brussels sprouts burned.
Okay? Why?
Because I said so.
Okay? Listen to this quote. This is important. Why was it important for God's people in the Old Covenant to eat the foods that God commanded and to refrain from eating the foods that God told them not to eat? The reason is God said so. When God commands his people to obey, they obey. In order to obey, all God's people need to know is that God commands. Now listen to this. Listen to this. This is important, okay? The more mature we become in our relationship with God, the more we are willing to obey unexplained commands. We tend to think different, don't we? The more mature I become, the more I have a right to know the reason why I'm supposed to obey. The more mature you become in your relationship with God, the more childlike you become in your faith. And you don't need to know if God doesn't tell you. Job thought he was pretty mature. God, why? I said, Job, look at all this. I said, God, I heard about you with the hearing of my ears. Now I've seen you with my eyes. My soul repents and I'm comforted, even though all you've given me is ashes. I'm comforted. David, when he writes, he says, my soul is like a weaned child. He's not yet at the why stage. He's still clinging to his parents, his mother. But he's not whimpering about it. He's satisfied so long as it's his mother there. The more mature I become in my faith, the more childlike I become in my trust, and the less need I have that question answered. Why? Because when push comes to shove at the end of the day, if I know what it is that I'm supposed to do, but I'm waiting for a reason that meets my satisfaction, who really is God in my life? I'm not going to obey until I know why. Because God said so. And that's reason enough. I wonder for you this morning, is that where your faith sits? In Leviticus, God is getting his people to the point where they're learning to ask first, what did God say? Then that's what I want to do. And he's going to explain stuff later on, but not yet. They're not ready for it yet. All they need to know is that their God said. Then this requires an act of obedience. And it's by obeying God's laws that Israel reflects God's holiness. And that's the whole point. He comes down to the end of this section and he says, so you be holy. Why? So that you look like me. So you reflect my holiness. This requires a process of discernment. What did God say? It requires an element of trust. Who said it? Then it requires an act of obedience. I think those are pretty simple things for us from Leviticus chapter 11. The second thing is going to take far less time. We need to learn to hate what God says is unclean. Verses 4 down through 43, he says, don't eat this, don't eat this, don't. God reveals what is unclean for his people. Basically, whatever's not clean is unclean and they can't eat. In verse 10, he says, anything that's not clean. In verse 12, everything that's not clean. Don't eat it. Don't eat it. Don't eat it. Sounds like Romans chapter 14, verse 21. Whatever does not proceed from faith is what? So I wonder if I should do this. If you wonder, don't. That's a pretty simple thing, isn't it? I wonder if I should. If you wonder, don't. Because God says, if you think it might be wrong and you're still willing to do it, that's wrong. That's wrong. If you're willing to do something you don't know that's right, that's wrong. If you can't do it in faith, then don't do it. Whatsoever is not of faith is sin. Especially that which is dead. In verse 8, verse 11, verse 27, verse 31, he's talking about those things that are unclean and die. You'll be defiled by them. Verse 39, he says, if it's clean and dies, you'll be defiled by it. But again, this time he does reveal why. Look at verse 24. And by these, what? You shall become unclean. It's a very, very powerful principle. The unclean has the power to corrupt and to defile. Unclean is contagious. Okay? Death brings death. These five chapters, Wenham writes, also serve to prepare the way for chapter 16, which describes the great Day of Atonement. The ceremonies on the Day of Atonement are ordained because of the uncleanness of the Israelites. He says, listen, stay away from the unclean because the unclean will make you unclean. He gets down to verses 32 through 36. He's talking about some foodware and so on. And we see that the earthenware vessels become contaminated. And the food and drink is corrupted because the vessel is corrupted because something unclean fell into it. At the end of the defilement is death. And so this center section focuses on carcasses and death, and if they fall on something, it's unclean. Reminds me of James chapter 1, verse 15. Then with seed, sin hath conceived, it bringeth forth, when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. At the end of the day, I can't love what's unclean because what's unclean brings death. At times it requires washing it in water. And there's a temporary defilement that lasts until evening. That is, until the time of the next sacrifice and the start of the next day. It's kind of a recalibrating of the clock, starting things fresh. At times it requires that the earthenware vessels be broken, or even a stove or an oven would have to be broken if this dead carcass would fall into it. There's exceptions of springs that are coming from new life, new water coming in, of seed that hasn't yet germinated, so it still has life within it. The outer husk is going to die. The life within is brand new. But if it's already germinated and becomes contaminated, then that plant becomes defiled. But there's a contamination that they're supposed to, it's not just unclean, but look what he says there in verse 10. Anything in the seas or rivers that does not have fins and scales of the swarming creatures, of the living creatures in the waters, that is what? It's detestable. It's an abomination. Verse 11, you shall regard them as detestable. End of the verse. And you shall detest their carcass. The word is strong. It means to spurn, to scorn, to abhor, to loathe, to hate, to consider an abomination. It's to revile. It's what happens when you see a spider in your shoe. Send shivers down your spine. I got so close to loving what is unlovely. Do we think of sin like that? I'm getting so close to loving what is unlovely. I'm getting so close to loving what is harmful. I'm getting so close to loving a skeleton that's eating and decaying my heart that's supposed to love holiness. I'm getting so close to loving maggots. God says, you shall hate it. Well, you know what? My heart doesn't naturally do it. I guess that's not your personality. You don't have to hate sin. No. I guess you're not grown up enough. You've got to learn to grow in your hatred of what's evil. You've got to learn to grow in what your heart hungers for and what your heart reviles. It comes down to verse 43, and he says, listen, if you don't hate this, if you refuse to detest what is unclean, verse 43, you will make yourself detestable and defiled before God. Look at verse 43. You shall not make yourselves detestable by loving these things. Not only do I need to learn to feed on what God calls clean, I need to learn to hate what God calls unclean because of its ability to corrupt and because of its ability to distance me from my God. So at the end of the day, end of the chapter, what is it that I'm supposed to learn to do? I have to learn to long for a deeper relationship with God. Look at verses 44 and 45. This is where all of this is going. We're going to spend the least amount of time on this, not because it's the least important, it's the most important. But we couldn't get here without the rest of the chapter. Verse 44. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not defile yourselves with any swarming thing that crawls on the ground. For I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt in order to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, because I'm holy. He says, understand that the work of redemption is complete. I am the Lord who already brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Jesus says, I am that bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never hunger. Whoever believes in me will never thirst. It's done. I've done it, and I've done it for you. Understand that the purpose of redemption is relationship. I brought you out of Egypt so that I can be what? So I can be your God. So you can be my people. I brought you out into the wilderness to slip this ring on your finger. With this ring, I thee wed. I, God, take you, sinner, to be my lawful bride. Wow. Understand that the means of relationship is holiness. You shall therefore be holy. Why? Because I'm holy. God cannot have an intimate relationship with unholiness. Remember Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14? Strive for holiness, without which no man shall what? See God. James 4, 6. God opposes the proud. He gives grace to those who are humble. God opposes those who are opposed to Him. Understand that the responsibility for intimacy lies with whom? Not with God. God's done everything that can be done so far. The responsibility for how close you are to God lies with you. If you get nothing else from this message, please write this down. You are as close to God as you choose to be. You are as close to God as you choose to be. God says, you want to know the secret to being close to me? Love what I love. Hate what I hate. Pursue a deeper relationship with me. It's really not any more difficult than that. You shall therefore not defile yourselves, but instead, therefore, you shall consecrate yourselves. Let's go to Philippians chapter 3. We'll close things this morning. Philippians chapter 3. Paul is writing to believers, and he says, I want to tell you, this makes me cry. I'm writing to those who are holy, but what I got to tell you brings a tear, not just to my heart, but to my eye. Chapter 3 of the book of Philippians, verse 18, he says, for many of whom I have often told you and now tell you even with tears, many walk as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is their destruction. Their God is their belly. They glory in their shame, and their minds are set on earthly things. You know what? It makes me cry. Because people can't get their lives, their loves off of the earth. They serve and worship their appetites. Folks, we've got to hone our heart to hunger God and His holiness. So we need to let God bring our appetites into submission. What does God use to do that? What does God use to cut the tie to loving this world in our lives? Trials, pain, tribulation. This morning we heard from Karen. She said, "You know what I'm thankful for? In the midst of the hardest year of my life, Jesus loves me, this I know. And I love Jesus too." Don't you want that to be your heart? God can only take your heart away from this world when you let go of this world and give Him your heart.